You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.
Today on our show, we're talking with Ann Landy. She is a writer and editor, lives in Taos, New Mexico, has written for 20 years as a contributing editor for Art News, features and profiles and reviews of the art world, and she continues to write for the Wall Street Journal and other publications, as well as other projects. Ann, thanks so much for being with us today.
Hi, it's my pleasure.
You're in Taos, New Mexico. Tell us a little bit about what's happening in the Southwest in terms of art and what you're involved in right now. What are you seeing? I suppose that...
Well, I just wrote a longish review for the Wall Street Journal about Site Santa Fe in Santa Fe, New Mexico. This is their first biennial in about 4 years. They skipped a year. And I was really pleased. It's exciting to see good contemporary art. And it's exciting to see a biennial with a focus such as Site Santa Fe has found this year, which is the art of the Americas. Most of it is, I would say, experimental, but very, very well done, very thoughtful, good installation art, good videos, all focused around the theme of landscape, trade, and territory, and the history of this region. And it's just thoroughly engaging. It was a great pleasure to be able to write about that.
Well, that sounds like a very strong theme it had, too, around, you know, that all the art was organized on a particular thesis or educational
right.
Idea.
Well, one of the complaints that the director, Irene Hoffman, discovered, and these are people who get a chance to go to biennials all over the world. We now have something like 150 biennials worldwide, which is pretty staggering. And what she and her co-curators found was that, you know, you're getting the same star curators, the same artists over and over again, and they wanted particularly to seek out artists who did not have so much visibility, and they wanted to have a strong thesis. And it just makes for a reviewer, for a critic, it makes for an engaging and lively and novel and surprising show. So that's been a breath of fresh air in the Southwest.
That's very interesting. It seems, you know, that there is, to challenge that particular idea that there is a clique of artists or a group that keeps getting shown.
Well, as you know, as a writer, I get to a fair amount of art shows and sometimes art fairs, and you do start seeing these superstars rising to the top, and those are the only names that people hear about, and that's not quite fair because I think, you know, what I saw at Site Santa Fe is that there are so many good artists out there doing mining different territory, traditional territory sometimes, but new territory, and I don't know where they're finding the funding to do this, but, you know, thank God we have them, and thank God there is this kind of, you know, as I said, a breath of fresh air, that there's something. You can get very jaded after a while writing about art, reading about the same people over and over again, whether it's Jeff Koons or whoever the superstar of the moment happens to be, Cindy Sherman. And, yeah, it's great.
True, there is these superstars, and maybe we should talk about Jeff Koons for a moment, if that's okay. I mean, having his show...
Yeah, you know, I was in New York early July. I went to see the show. Of course, there was so much noise preceding it, and there has been so much noise after it. And I had several things that what I found was that his best work was in the 80s, early in his career. There was some stuff that I found intriguing and moving, the basketballs in the tanks of water, a couple of bronze pieces that showed that this guy could have gone, I think, in a much more cerebral direction and a much more interesting direction. And instead, he kind of chose to go trashy in a way. He chose to be... big and loud and I don't know what would be a comparison really in other fields, but and one of the things I found troubling that I started thinking about, maybe I will write about this at some point because it's happened on a very small scale here in Taos, but the idea that Gagosian apparently contributed significant financial support to the show, this is not good. I mean, and then I remember reading when Cindy Sherman had her retrospective at the MoMA, And Jed Pearl, who is sometimes one of my favorite critics, really took the museum to task because so many of the trustees of MoMA own Cindy Sherman's work. So when you get this meddling of the commercial, of the collecting worlds, of the marketing worlds, in the museum world, it's not good. I find that very disturbing. So that's your mind.
Is there a way really to avoid that? I mean, I know when I was, I remember hearing this argument when I was in the Whitney Biennial in 2002, and the argument that year, or the controversy that year, was so many of the artists were not represented by a gallery. And what that really translated into it, I was one of those artists that wasn't, you know, represented by a gallery. So these were unknown artists that no one ever heard of, and more importantly, the trustees didn't have them in their collection already, which was the first time I had heard this idea of the trustees of a museum want their artists to be shown so that their collections increase, which is, you know, kind of like insider trading, but it seemed to be very open the way they were talking about it, and that the trustees were very straightforward with the director and saying we're disappointed in this way of mounting a show.
So what are you asking me?
Well, I'm saying, so is this seems to be a trend that's been happening for a while, and seems to be something that...
Yeah, well,
saying,
I guess what I'm wondering is why don't we hear more about this? Why don't we, as the audience, as the art-going public... the first time I think I was made aware of it was when, you remember the Sensation Show at the Brooklyn Museum?
Sure.
And those were all artists from...
The major collector had funded...
Right. I mean, I don't think this is right. I don't think this is the way to go. I know it provides money for the museum, and it provides funding, and it gets a certain number of artists out there, but I think curators ought to be like the church. They really ought to be... A separate entity from the state, which is to say the commercial world, the marketing world. And the curators ought to be the ones making the decisions, and they shouldn't be getting funding from galleries, from dealers. That, to me, is wrong.
Well, especially if it's a lot of funding, like you're saying in the Jeff Koons show, I mean, that Gagosian helped fund that show, which was obviously in his own interest, you know, the question is how much funding did he give the show?
I don't know. That I don't know. I mean, that's not something I've looked into, but you know, if
I
were to do...
That should be public information.
I think it should be. And I'm actually going to... Art News has a new editor now, and I haven't been much in touch with her. So I'm just going to propose, you know, how much meddling is going on here, and how much of a tradition is there of this? It's a big reporting story. Whether I can take it on or not, I don't know. I'm getting lazier
as I get
older.
Then it becomes less about it becomes less about obviously the art and what's happening, and about financial relationships between these institutions that are becoming run more like corporations or businesses, like the Whitney. I mean, the Jeff Koons show. What I'm seeing in my Facebook feed and other places is critics often coming to bat for Jeff Koons, and artists generally feeling repulsed by what he's doing. Not all artists, but a lot of what I see is artists saying, you know, there's no depth in this. This is all surface. There's no poetry. There's
Well, the question, when I first started studying art history 30 years ago, and I was fortunate enough to study with Kirk Varnadoe at Columbia, and I fell in love with Rodin as far as sculpture was concerned. And then I wrote a master's essay on David Smith, and there's a certain kind of sculpture that I've always loved. And then you see Jeff Koons' Mound of Play-Doh, and you think, good God, is this what sculpture has come to? Have we gone through, you know, from Rodin to Brent Clusey to David Smith to Richard Serra to Robert Smithson, only to arrive at Jeff Koons' Mound of Play-Doh? It is depressing. It's awful. And, you know, you've got major critics. You've got Jerry Saltz. You've got Roberta Smith. You've got Peter Sheldahl, all saying this guy is important.
And why are they saying that? What do you think about that? Because I've read
those
reviews.
I don't know. The best review I read was Peter Plagans in the Wall Street Journal, who really kind of nailed it. He said it's like eating too much cotton candy at the State Fair, that it's just overload.
Well, maybe,
right,
you know, you could make, if you were to take it from an art historical vantage point, are we getting the kind of art that our times deserve?
Maybe we live in very superficial, silly times, and this is, you know, this is the best we can come up with.
Fine, let's talk about that, because, you know, in a way, we do live in superficial times, but that's kind of a difficult assessment to make. I mean, you could say that when Andy Warhol was working, and what does superficial times mean? There are still artists, thinkers, critics, intellectuals who mm-hmm. are interested in experiences that have depth and meaning. I don't think that the general public has ever decided, or that there's been a trend away from depth and meaning. It would be easy to say there's evidence to the contrary, but isn't that a human desire? It's like saying there's a move away from love. We all want meaning and depth when we look at artwork. We don't want just the opposite, do we?
Well, I think you want to have some kind of what some critics have called an aesthetic emotion. You don't want to feel repulsed. I don't know. It's a very difficult question, because when I was going through the Jeff Koons show, one of the things I was thinking, I kept thinking about Dwayne Hansen. Do you remember him?
Sure.
I kept thinking, does anybody remember Dwayne Hansen? You know, 30 years ago, that was considered great sculpture. It was tricky, and it was intriguing, and it fooled the eye, and it was very beautifully made, as is Jeff Koons' work. You can't deny that stuff is just exquisitely well made, because he has 125 people working for him, for one thing. But it doesn't, you know, you're not left with anything. You're not left with anything to think about or to enjoy or to reflect on. So my prediction is in 20 years, Jeff Koons will be gone. But here's another, you know, because I love art history, and I love finding out these little factoids. In Titian's day, his heyday, like the mid-16th century, the most popular artist was a guy named Pordenone, P-O-R-D-E-N-O-N-E, and you can look him up. But he specialized in doing these real special effects kind of murals that showed a horse bursting through the wall, or some, you know, really, really tricky trompe-l'oeil stuff. And he's more popular than Titian. Well, look who survived. We aren't going to know for maybe 100 years.
That's true. And it's interesting to know, I mean, not knowing that other artist, why is it that he didn't survive? Was it at that time, what could have arguably said, this is, you know, appealing to a superficial sensibility, a superficial aesthetic that, you know, the world is spiraling towards in the 17th century. But in fact, it was...
But, you know, you had, in the Renaissance, at least you had collectors. There's a certain amount of discrimination and taste. And they worked hard to understand aesthetics. They worked hard to understand their own culture. You know, you think of somebody like Lorenzo de' Medici or some of the cardinals and popes that supported the artists of the day, supported Raphael, supported Michelangelo, whatever. And these guys really cared about culture and learning and being of their times. And the kind of, you know, the kind of collectors we have now are cookie cutter collectors. If Eli Broad has a set of Cindy Sherman prints, well, I have to have a set of Cindy Sherman prints. I don't feel like they set out to educate their eye or to go out there on their own and find out what's important to them.
That's true. But wasn't some of that also happening with the Medicis? I mean, I remember reading, and correct me if I'm remembering this wrong, but Vasari saying that, you know, at the time, the way it was being described, if you had a mural by Michelangelo or Da Vinci or whoever it was, though it was beautiful in your house, it wasn't so much the artist that was important. In the same way, if you had gorgeous wallpaper in your house, it's you whose house this is, who chose that wallpaper, that's getting all the glory, not the artist. The artist is a worker, like the wallpaper is a worker, and is not not getting the kind of glory that the Medicis got or anybody had.
Well, then you have to ask why was Da Vinci in such huge demand that he really couldn't satisfy all his patrons? He was really pretty much off on his own tangents. I mean, granted, I see what you're saying. There was the same competitive instinct among collectors to have the best.
And so now it's true. I mean, the collecting certainly has changed, and the art world has vastly changed. You know, not just since the Renaissance, but even since the 70s, with a skull art sale and all of this money swirling around. What are the trends in the art world that you see that are hopeful and that are?
What I see, you know, when I was in New York, I was down on the Lower East Side, just kind of popping in and out of these new galleries, and I always see younger artists who are pursuing their own vision, and often very good and interesting, and they're gonna, you know, people who want to be artists are always going to be artists. They can't help themselves. And the museum world will keep track of them and will keep an eye on them. Good curators will always be out there looking at good art. And even though, you know, all the noise is about Jeff Koons right now, but there's got to be a whole lot else going on in New York at the moment. I mean, I don't know how you felt about Sigmar Polka. I had a very mixed reaction to that. But at least it was a different kind of artist. So, I mean, there's a lot of the good side of all this. I think a lot of people are interested in the visual arts. I see more money being funneled into museums, into endowing curators' chairs, into just the general public finding it intriguing to know, see what's going on out there.
And
these are really kind of broad statements.
Yeah, but it's true. I mean, I also feel as a New Yorker too, that Lower East Side is a very exciting scene. There's all kinds of new galleries. I mean, what I find especially interesting is galleries that are brand new, that are trying hard to establish their own vision and are showing new artists who perhaps haven't shown before, but they're really taking risks. I mean, like all the galleries, they'd like to make more money. They'd like to be in Basel eventually, and some are and some aren't. But there seems to be a lot of activity that's not all about what Chelsea used to be thought of as these kind of, you know, shiny surfaces everywhere that was talked about for a while. There's a lot of experimenting going on, and I think it's exciting what's happening there. When you review shows of artists, what is it that you're? How do you approach a review? I've talked to a number of different reviewers, and everybody seems to handle it a little differently. The reviewer that I've been most influenced by, partly because of a personal connection, also interviewed a while ago, was the late Arthur Danto, who
he was wonderful.
He was wonderful, right? But he also felt that a critic's role or a reviewer's role wasn't necessarily to criticize, but to be curious. Barry Schwabsky said he felt that Arthur was wrong there. What do you feel? How do you approach a review, and what's your role?
Well, what I'm looking for, bear in mind that Arthur Danto had the luxury of writing about 1,500 words for The Nation. They let him go on at any length, and he had a very philosophical cast of mind. And I appreciated his reviews because I felt, you know, even though maybe I didn't like Damien Hirst, even though I didn't like Jeff Koons, I felt that he took the time to get under the surface and to examine, like, the psychodynamics of these artists. Most of my reviews are less than 300 words long, so because that's the formula at Art News. There's not too much I can do about that. What I look for when I'm seeing new work, when I'm seeing new shows, I'd look for somebody who's breaking out of the box in some interesting way. For instance, I just reviewed a show of geometric art at a Lower East Side gallery, and I won't go into specifics, but I was so intrigued that here were people who were really in the lineage of, let's say, constructivism, Joseph Albers, Frank Stella, and they were finding new ways to extend that language. So that's what I like to see. I like to see something that takes art history and tweaks it
in some way. Or I like to see an artist who's it's like a line of music or something, like jazz maybe, who takes a line of melody and can really just push it in interesting new directions. I don't know if this makes sense, but
it makes a lot of sense. I mean, to me, that sounds like also that's also who you are and your reference point. You're interested in art history, and you've read a lot about art history from, you know, the Renaissance till now. And when you see artists doing things that are referencing a type of history and departing from it, if that's what breaking out of the box means,
exactly,
that's exciting to you.
Exactly. And it's hard to explain to people who haven't been looking at art most of their life. I'm sure this is true of an enophile or a food connoisseur or a music critic, that you know what the language is because you've been hearing it or seeing it all your life. And so you know, but I can't really judge a piece of music. I don't have that aptitude. But I respect people who say, oh, you know, that guy really knows his Debussy, and or this composer has really broken new ground or whatever, because they can hear it. And I like to feel that I can see it. Maybe it's arrogance on my part, but hey, our life experiences have to count for something.
Well, that's right. I mean, that's the lens you're looking at through. Just as Arthur Danto, you're looking, as I understand it, through an art historical lens. Arthur Danto was looking at things through a philosophical lens.
Right, exactly.
I guess a question I have is, so when artists are producing works, and for many artists, critics are, or anybody who reviews their work is enormously important. It's a huge part of what they want in their career, which is a type of validation, a type of understanding from someone else. Is there other ways, I mean, I'd like to explore a little more the idea of how artists are making work. Some of them are very conscious about perhaps referencing history and departing from it, but is there another way of working that's also attracted to you? Is it possible to not reference history and make art that you find engaging, or are they always linked?
Well, you know, I think sometimes some of the artists who are most difficult to understand, let us say, maybe the Earthworks guys, when they first started out, Robert Smithson and Walter Di Maria and that generation, or someone like Bruce Nauman, or who else am I thinking of, Barbara Kruger. A lot of critics will say when they first encountered this work, they were just totally baffled. I mean, what's going on here? I don't get it. So I think, sure, there are always great artists who are trying to make it new, who are just trying to come up with something that departs entirely from everything we know about art. And Nauman's a great example. I mean, Nauman is still a problem for a lot. He's still a problem for me. But there's got to be something there, because people I respect think he's enormously important.
And it's a problem for you in a sense, because there's so little to reference in terms of what he's drawing from.
There's a problem in that he seems to be deliberately out to annoy people. And he does it so well. But a lot of critics think that's pretty cool.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, what do we love about art? We love about art that it surprises us, it pushes us someplace new. Sometimes it's provoking, sometimes it's just staggeringly beautiful in a ravishingly visual sense, the way that some of Gerhard Richter's paintings are just plain drop-dead gorgeous. So we go to it for lots of different things. But I think as a critic, as a reviewer, you've always got to be kind of open to something, unless it looks like somebody is just not making the effort. And I see that from time to time, too. Just lazy art.
Right, art that just seems like it's trying to do as little as possible, kind of thing.
Well, you know, I think sometimes there's a certain arrogance on the part of younger artists. I remember seeing one show on the Lower East Side that was such sloppy, bad painting. And I just kind of walked in, took one look, and walked out. And it looked like bad graduate school work. I couldn't believe that the dealer even bothered to show this stuff.
Hmm.
But maybe he or she thought, oh, well, there must be something there. Maybe this artist is on to something.
Hmm. Yeah, I suppose, I mean, the reaction that I initially had to art, or, you know, which is, I suppose, different from a reviewer, although that could happen as well, but is often one that's entirely emotional. I don't know if you know the work of another artist who recently died, Jennifer Wynne Reeves, whose work was hard to describe, but it was oftentimes figurative and just had this kind of, to me, poetic power. I looked at it and, you know, though it may have referenced other things and had titles that were kind of quirky and funny, there was just something gorgeous about it that was hard to define. There's a few artists I know like that have been the standout ones for me that I just think how did this come to be? And it's something that's kind of, I mean, I'm not a reviewer, but it's something that was sort of wordless and doesn't really may have references, but is purely emotional. I think that's a big part of what we want from art, isn't it? An emotional experience.
Yeah, of course. Hmm. And as I was saying, I think it can provoke many different emotions. In the case of Jeff Koons, it seems to be mostly irritation and bafflement. And although, you know, it's not to be dismissed entirely. But yeah, I mean, don't you? I mean, there's a whole different reaction you're going to get from looking at a Bruce Nauman piece than from, as I was saying earlier, from looking at one of these ravishingly, you know, I'm thinking the Gerhard Richter, Bader Meinhof gang, which I think is a series that he did that I think some of the most powerful, but also just drop-dead gorgeous painting of the 20th century. And I mean, you're going to have a very different, to take people in their own time, you're going to have a very different response to someone like Duchamp from the response you have to maybe early George O'Keefe. They're different, they tickle different parts of the brain.
In closing, I think one of the last things I'd like to discuss with you is the relationship of artists to critics and the relationship of how artists are even interpreting this interview. There's, you know, a sense that artists are trying to, they'd like the attention of people who are interviewing them. They'd like to have art that is reviewed. Is there anything you want to say to them about that? Of course, we don't want artists to make work thinking it's going to be reviewed, but it's powerful to also talking about what it means when you say to break outside the box or to reference art history. Do you feel there are things artists should be keeping in mind when approaching work from your point of view?
I'm not quite clear on what you're asking.
Well,
I guess what
I'm asking is artists are interested in how you're thinking and how reviewers are thinking. Is
well, you know what I would
reference history or?
I think artists, if they're any good, they're going to be pursuing their own direction. We don't know where inspiration comes from. You as an artist certainly probably are hit by some kind of divine lightning now and then and say, oh, yeah, that's the way to go. Or you're thinking, wow, I'm really working on all eight cylinders or whatever. I don't think artists should worry about critics too much. You know, that's a story I'll have to suggest this to Art News. I've often wondered if artists read what critics have to say about them, especially early in their careers, and if they should be paying attention. I would say, you know, if you're an artist and you like the body of work you're doing or you're uncertain about it and you have a friend who's a critic or has some background or has some real interest in being visual, you know, do a studio visit. Get a dialogue going. Find out if that's meaningful to you. Is this answering your question at all? I'm not sure.
Yeah, it is. It is. I mean, and I think also the article that you're mentioning talking about is interesting, is what is the effect that a critic can have on an artist? There was.
I have talked to critics about this, and I know that they will be very careful with a young artist, Irving Sandler, who's been around forever and is a very astute, smart guy and was a big champion of the abstract expressionists. And he said, you know, he always felt free during his career when somebody was a big established name and making a fool of themselves, he always felt free to kind of deliver a 1-2 punch. But with a younger artist, he was always very careful about what he said. And I've heard, you know, people who are literary critics say the same thing about novelists, that you really, artists are for the most part really putting themselves out there, and yes, they want the attention and they want to make a name, but it's what they do. But I think every critic needs to be careful with a young artist and not be defeating and not be dismissive, because you just never know where someone's going to go.
That's right. Yeah, I agree, which is why I always admire the writings of Arthur Danto in particular, as well as others, and as well as your writing. Arthur seemed to me always very gentle in how he explored ideas and seemed so
exactly. And always very thorough. And as I say, there really aren't that many critics who have the luxury of 1,500 plus words to look at something and to turn it inside out and to come at it from a philosophical point of view, because most magazines want to publish lots and lots of reviews. And but he was an exceptionally thoughtful, wonderful guy, no question about it. And I would have loved for him to be around to see the retrospective and to read what he would have had to say about Jeff Koons. Because he was a supporter at one point.
That would have been interesting. I mean, you know, it's the last time I interviewed him, he also, very rarely was he critical, but I began asking him about Jerry Saltz and the kind of attention he's getting. And he had some pretty strong words for what Jerry Saltz was doing. He felt that Jerry Saltz...
What did he say?
It was really wonderful. He said, well, I think Jerry Saltz is a very average person writing whatever he thinks. And he's not really doing it through a particular viewpoint. And he said, and beyond that, he said, I think many times he has no business saying what he's saying. He said, I was once at a lecture with Jerry, and we were talking about William Kentridge. And he started saying, oh, William Kentridge, you know, he's an animator. He has no business doing those kind of drawings in a gallery. That's not the kind of artist he does. And he said, Roberta does the same thing. She'll say something about an artist. He has no business doing that. He can't get away with that.
Well, it's devastating. I mean, it's devastating when you are writing for the New York Times or New York magazines or New York Magazine, and these are major platforms. And I don't know. I feel like Jerry Saltz spends so much time on Facebook, it's a wonder he even gets to the galleries. So it's more like he'll never talk to me again anyway, so I don't care. It's more like he's cultivating a fan base rather than acting like a critic. But you got to a point that I find very interesting. And it's why I would never call myself a critic. I'm a reviewer. I write reviews of things. I think a really good critic, whether it's Arthur Danto or Clement Greenberg or Harold Rosenberg or John Ruskin, even if you disagree with a lot of what John Ruskin had to say, they come out of a point of view. They come from some kind of a philosophical or aesthetic grounding about what they think is good and what they think is not good. And we don't see much of that anymore. I admire somebody who sticks to his or her ground. But I don't really have that. I don't think I'm smart enough, but I do the best I can.
Thanks so much for talking with us. Is there anything you want to leave artists with? Is there anything else you want to say to the artists that are listening to this in closing?
Well, you know, if this is your life, Louise Bourgeois once said to me, and I try to remind my artist friends of this thought when they're going through great frustrations with getting shows or with making a living. She said it is a great privilege to be an artist. And I think that was a wonderful thought. And that's something that you have to, even when things seem a little lean or you're not getting the attention you want, it's a wonderful thing to be able to create work and to have that way of being in the world. So, yeah, that's about all I would say in closing.
Thank you so much, Anne, for talking with us today. It's really been a pleasure.
Thanks. It was great.
You're listening to Yale Radio WIBC. This is Brainerd Carey with The Art World Demystified.